need this high.
Counting down. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Welcome to X, my friends. Good to be here, Sunday, February 8th, in the not-so-frozen tundra of Idaho. The solar wind tonight is 358 kilometers per second. There are no sunspots, again. Maybe something on the other side of the sun knows what's going on here. Where is solar cycle 24? A slight coronal hole is sending a solar wind to Earth that should arrive on the 13th or 14th, maybe. There's a slight chance for an aurora, so keep your eyes open for that. Drivers, better buckle up or pay the price. More cash-strapped states want to give law enforcement officers the authority to pull over motorists just for not wearing their seatbelts. More than a dozen states that are considering making the switch to primary seatbelt enforcement laws need to do so before July to be eligible for millions in federal money. Congress adopted the federal incentive program in the 2005 Federal Transportation Bill as a way to encourage states to adopt the primary law enforcement. The goal was to save lives, reduce insurance costs, and cut medical bills. The Traffic Safety Agency found that in 2007, 54% of passenger vehicle occupants killed in traffic accidents were not wearing seatbelts. You see, that is another statistic. That means that 46% of the people involved in traffic accidents dying were wearing seatbelts. Well, if you obey the traffic laws, it's now bad for the economy. It also gives open license to illegal search and seizure. Hope you have your papers in order. This is just a sign of larger things, Earth Explorers. Reporting from Washington, California's farms and vineyards could vanish by the end of the century, and its major cities could be in jeopardy if Americans do not act to slow the advance of global warming. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu said Tuesday, "I don't think the American public has gripped in its gut what could happen," he said. "We're looking at a scenario where there's no more agriculture in California." And he added, "I don't actually see how they can keep their cities going either." A pair of recent studies raise similar warnings. One, published in January in the journal Science, raised the specter of worldwide crop shortages as temperatures rise. Another, penned by UC Berkeley researchers last year, estimated California has about $2.5 trillion in real estate assets, including agriculture, endangered by warming. Experienced observers report that Comet Lulin has brightened to naked eye visibility from dark sky sights. It looks like a pale, fuzzy patch in the constellation Libra before dawn. Backyard telescopes pointed at the patch reveal a lovely green comet with a rapidly regrowing plasma tail. Also in the news, steam is pouring out of Mount Redoubt, and Alaskan volcano geologists fear could erupt any time. Scientists collected gas samples from the mountain while checking for signs of an eruption. I would call that the snatch and run. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says a steam plume was again spotted yesterday, coming from above the 7,000-foot level near a dome that formed after the last redoubt eruption in 1990. We also have a call in to Charlotte Webb, who might be listening tonight. She might call in and give us an update. As you know, she is the sensitive that knows and has documented abilities for when earthquakes and volcanic activity is about to take place. Maybe we can get a prediction right down to the hour from her. Last week, we were scheduled to have Walter Cruttenden on the program. He was unavoidably detained and had some technical problems, so we have rescheduled him for the 8th of March. So get your quadruple paper out, because that program will explain things to you about the behavior of our solar system well beyond your imagination. This week, we have the author of The God Experiments. He is a professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery at the University of Arizona. Prepare yourself for scientific proof. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, Dr. Gary Schwartz. How are you?
Very good, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing really well. The year has just started out, you know, like a rocket ship. We're really going to town on this new biodiesel plant here in Idaho. We finished the one in Washington, and it's up and running. And gosh, it's making fantastic biodiesel. And hopefully, we're headed toward lowering global warming gases with that plant right now.
Well, I'll vote for that, and I suspect billions of other people will vote for that, too.
I hope so. One thing we're excited about is the federal government has kind of gotten behind it now, and there are several federal loan guarantees and grant programs out there. So if you're in the field of renewable energy, get your word processors ready. Some of these applications can be pretty hairy. Anyway, tonight we're going to talk about your book, The God Experiments, How Science is Discovering God in Everything, Including Us. I so enjoyed our last interview, I think it was in December, on the afterlife experiments. That was amazing.
Well, I enjoyed it, too. As we discussed, it's not every day that I speak with someone who is as knowledgeable, thoughtful, critical, and open as you are. And also as a program that where you could actually get into some of this conversation in depth. So for me, it was refreshing, to say the least.
Well, that's good. That's one of the things I like about this format is we have 3 hours, which goes by in about 20 minutes. But I move all the commercials to the top of the hour, so we can literally speak for almost an hour straight. And then we can get into depth on things. So before we get too far into this, I want to ask you a question. I'm sure Earth explorers everywhere are sitting on the edge of their seats waiting for this. So let's get started. Tell us about the experiment with Chris Robinson.
Ah, boy. Okay. That was, I would have to say, a life-transforming experiment, and it's worth our reviewing in some depth, and also playfully. It started, by the way, quite unexpected to me, meaning that literally, seemingly out of the blue, I received a phone call from England, from a gentleman who I had never heard of, who was calling me, claiming to be, quote, the dream detective. That's what the label he had received in England. This was a gentleman, Christopher Robinson, who claimed that he was able to see the future in his dreams. In particular, the future that related to terrorist activity, catastrophes, and other such events. And his story of how this happened was remarkable enough. But moreover, he was claiming that he was calling me because he felt that there was a desperate need for for science to verify what he was doing, and he was led through multiple sources to call me. Now, here's what his claim was. He claimed that he had been an undercover agent for Scotland Yard and British intelligence, and that he had always been intuitive, but had not taken it seriously until he had a near-death experience, where he almost died, and he had some of the classic symptoms of a near-death experience, including leaving his body and having awareness of a light. And in his case, so he claimed, he was asked whether he wished to come back or not. And he decided that he wanted to come back because he wanted to be with his children. And supposedly he was told that he could come back, but only if he would serve as a bridge between here and, quote, there. And when he returned, he began having these precognitive dreams. Now, remember, he was already working as an undercover agent, so mm-hmm. he was already connected to the police and to the powers that be. And as he recounts in a book that he wrote called The Dream Detective, he had a particular dream where he saw terrorists who had already done something, I don't remember the details, but they were planning to do another terrorist act. And he saw them located in a particular town, on a particular street, in a particular hotel, and literally in a particular room, which is highly detailed information. He then passed this information on to the whoever the field operatives that he was dealing with. They eventually checked this out and sure enough discovered these terrorists there. And they immediately brought him in for questioning because they couldn't figure
really?
Out.
Really? Oh, they thought he was involved because he had
exactly. How could he have gotten this detailed information? You know, what kind of operative was he? Okay. And he didn't know what to say. So he, by the way, we're having an echo right now.
Let me see. Oh, we are? I'm sorry about that. I can't hear it.
Okay, well, maybe it'll stop. That's bizarre. I haven't heard that in a long time. Anyway, he said, look, he said, I'm getting this information in my dreams. I know this is strange. Of course, they didn't believe him. So he said, look, lock me up. Watch me 24/7. And let's see if I have any other dreams about unrelated potential crimes. And if it turns out that I get information that clearly is unrelated to these events, and you know that I'm not connected to them, then will you believe me? So, of course, that's what they did. At least this is a story that he says. And he was locked up, and he had future dreams, and lo and behold, his dreams were verified. And as a result, the police then took him seriously. And he then, for a number of years, provided now secret information from his dreams, which turned out to be sometimes really useful. He actually would end up testifying in court based on information that he was receiving, so he had to be very evidence-based. And the other thing that was very interesting was that sometimes he would get information about questionable activities of the police, i.e. crimes that were being done by police officers and other law enforcement. So it didn't always make him popular with the law enforcement. Anyway, he wanted to be tested scientifically, and he did a whole slew of television programs for various English television shows, did demonstrations. I saw a number of them because after we began to communicate, he sent me, you know, examples of these TV shows. And I realized that there was a possibility that he was real. They have to understand, I had never heard of anybody doing this kind of thing. This was a complete and utter surprise to me. And what he said to me was, he said, I want you to test me. And he says, I'm willing to come to Tucson on my own expense. I'll pay my own transportation, my own hotel, and so on. All I want you to do is to give me your time and to rigorously test me, to design an experiment that will convince you that there's something real here. So we
interesting.
Designed, isn't that interesting? And so
yeah.
we designed the following experiment. Let me tell you what it is that he proposed that we do, which I then helped him further design. What he wanted me to do was to, what he was going to do is he was going to come to Tucson, and for 10 consecutive nights, he was going to dream about where he would be taken the next day. So each night he would go to sleep, and he'd say, universe, where am I being taken the next day? He would then record the information in his dreams, and then I would meet with him the next morning, and we would go through this information, okay? And the sites that we were to go to for these 10 consecutive days, I was supposed to select at the end of July. Now, by the way, we had we designed the experiment in April, but he wasn't able to come out, and my schedule didn't permit him to come out until the beginning of August. So at the end of July, what I was supposed to do was to pick 10 different sites in the greater southern Arizona area. Okay? What I actually did was I picked 20 instead of 10. The reason I picked 20 was that if I knew what all 10 sites were, by the time we got to the 10th day, I would know what the last site was. But if there were 20 possible sites, then on the 10th day, there would still be 11 possible sites.
Right, then it could stay random all the way through.
Exactly. What I would then do at the end of, when I would pick these 20 sites, I would write them down and put them on a card in individual envelopes, or a piece of paper, actually, and then fold them and then seal the envelope. So now I had 20 different envelopes, okay? I then shuffled them, and then what I did was I mailed them to my writing partner, who was living in California. He then gave the envelopes to a third person that I was not privy to. The third person then randomly shuffled the envelopes, and this person numbered them from 1 to 20. So envelope 1 to... Excuse me?
Yeah, I'm here.
So the envelopes 1 through 10 were going to be the 10 days from 1 to 10, and then envelopes 11 through 20 would be the ones that we never opened. Okay?
Right.
And then when Christopher was to come to Tucson, he would, as I said, he'd go to sleep at night. He would dream whatever information he would receive. We would then review the information the next day. He would then pick the themes, because remember, he was the detective. He knew how to interpret this information about what the primary pieces of core information would be. Then and only then, and I videotaped all of this, then and only then would I call my writing partner, who would then contact the third person who I was kept blind to. This person would then open the envelope, and now we would know, he would know where it would be. He would then call me back and say, okay, you're going to the Desert Museum, for example, which is outside of Tucson. So this is now the first time that I would know where we were going. I would not tell Christopher where we were going. I would also not tell my writing partner, Bill Simon, what the information from his dreams were. Christopher and I would then pack our cameras, video cameras, and also digital still photos, and then I would drive him to the site the way I would normally drive to the site. And we would check and see what pieces of information en route and at the site fit. After we did this, we would come back to the hotel. We would go through the information, see which pieces of information fit, which pieces of information didn't fit, and that would end the experiment for the day. And then the rest of the day, whatever else he dreamt, I would not count it. Now, by the way, he claimed that his dreams would get information between 12 and 24 hours of the day, so there was going to be more information for the day than just the experimental period. But I was not going to count that, even if it was accurate, okay? Now, this is the really weird part. So we decided on this experiment in April. And then he tells me, okay, Gary, I'm going to start dreaming now. And I said, excuse me, you're going to do what? He says, yeah, he says, I like to get lots of data. He says, so I'm going to dream for 10 days in May, 10 days in June, and 10 days in July, where I'm going to be taken on each of the consecutive days. And I said, Christopher, excuse me, I haven't even yet picked the sites. And you're going to be dreaming about them.
Wow. This is like triple blind. Unbelievable.
This is totally unbelievable. I said, Christopher, I can't handle that. I said, I have a difficult enough time imagining that I've actually picked the sites, that they're in the hands of someone and I don't know which one's coming next, but they're at least in the envelopes. And then you go to sleep and you dream when you're in Tucson. I said, but you're the dream detective. So you do whatever it is that you do, because I'm testing what your claims are. See? So he comes to Tucson with 30 nights of dreams. 3 nights for each of the 10 days. Okay? So that's how the experiment began. So now the question is, of course, what happened in the experiment? And I'll summarize for you and your listeners the basic finding, and then we'll go through sample days so the listeners can understand how it was that I came to the conclusion that this experiment was more than just about seeing the future. First of all, he was accurate for 10 out of 10 days. Every day he got detailed information that fit the specific sites.
I would ask myself the question, and maybe the listeners are out there too wondering, you know, when I go to bed, maybe I can, you know, pre-suggest what I'm going to dream about during the night, but dreams have a way of just kind of going their own path, you know. How did Christopher manage to go to sleep each night, or each of the 3 nights that he dreamt about each day that you were going to go out, and say, I want to dream about this day, what is going to happen on day 1, and then, you know, not speak like, say, Edgar Casey would at night and record it, but wake up and then write down what he dreamt about? Well, that sounds like a very complex process.
It is. He would actually sleep separately from his wife when he would do this. He would go to sleep with one of these pens that light up at night, and he would wake up 3 or 4 times in the night and record what his dreams were.
Wow.
Remember, this guy is a professional dreamer. He had been doing this already for 10 to 15 years.
Ah.
Before he met me. So this was... Again, he was living a life that you and I and most normal people have never even heard of. Okay,
talk about sleeping disorders.
Yes, absolutely. So let's now give you an example of the day that was the transformative day, the first day that led me to think there's more that's going on here, and ultimately it's going to speak to the God question, the God hypothesis.
Uh-huh.
It was day 5. Christopher has the following... dreams the following information. He says that he's seeing a border. It looks like a border crossing. He says there are policemen holding up traffic. He says he sees a water tower. It's a tower holding water. He says he sees a car with flat tires. He sees... boats, lots of boats. Remember, this is the desert in Tucson. He sees boats, lots of boats. He sees this car that has a flat tire, or flat tires. The car has no oil, and he writes down it has no mineral oil, which is a bizarre thing to say. He also says the car reminds him of a British embassy. All of this is going to turn out to be important. He also says he sees a rows of tires along a chain-link fence. He says he sees me needing a credit card to get into some sort of store. He says he sees lots of umbrellas. And then he says he sees something about the Spirit of God. Now, when I heard that crazy list of items, and I'm trying to imagine... which of the 16 possible sites were left that it could have been. The only one I could imagine that would conceivably fit all of those was the Mexican border town called Nogales. The reason is there's policemen, it's like a border. You have to, you know, stop to get through. There are cars with flat tires. People tow boats to go to the ocean, which is a few hours south. The They have umbrellas there, I presume. I didn't know what it had to do with the Spirit of God or me requiring a credit card, but at least a lot of the things potentially fit, okay? Well, we get all this information down. I then call my writing partner in California. He then contacts the third person who had the envelopes. The person opens the envelope. He then calls me back, and he said, Gary, you're going to the gem and mineral store in South Tucson.
Oh, no.
And my response was, I said, great, because I thought he was wrong. I actually thought Christopher had gotten the information wrong, because at this point, he had already been accurate on four of the previous days, and I couldn't believe it. So him being wrong was actually, for me, a positive sign. But nonetheless, of course, I didn't tell him that I thought he was wrong, and we got our stuff and we started traveling. And I drove to I'd only been to this gem and mineral store a few times before, but I had really liked it. And I drove the route that I normally would drive to the store. And we're about a mile from the store, and Christopher says to me, he says, Gary, he says, are we near the border? And I said, no, Christopher. I said, the Mexican border is at least 40 miles from here. He said, Gary, my dream is very clear. There's a policeman, and there's something to do with the border holding up traffic. I said, I'm sorry, Christopher. We're not near the border. Well, maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, he says, look, Gary, there's a policeman holding up traffic on a side street. Let's turn down there. Now, by the way, how often are policemen holding up traffic?
Pretty regularly, yeah.
Yeah.
That was an easy guess.
Yeah, that's not going to count for much of anything. But nonetheless, we pull down the side street, and there are policemen holding up traffic. The reason that policemen are holding up traffic is because there is construction going on. And it turns out, in the area where the construction is a water tower. Now, remember, Christopher said water tower. And I looked at the name on the water tower, and I couldn't believe it. The name of the company on the water tower was a company called Borderland. Now, when I saw Borderland, I said, water tower, border, policeman holding up traffic. That sounds like a pattern. So I noted it. We then drive a little bit further along, and a car trailing a boat passes us. I then notice on the right-hand side of the road is a boat storage yard. Now, you have to remember, this is Tucson. There's not a lot of boats in Tucson, but there's this boat storage yard. We then make a right turn to go toward finally to the last street, which is with the gem and mineral stroller, and there is a rack, two racks, each holding four canoes, which again are more boats. I said, gee, that's a lot of boats. Well, we finally get to the gem and mineral store. And of course, he never said gem and mineral store. And sitting in front of the gem and mineral store is a car with four flat tires. Now, when Christopher saw this, he went sort of crazy. Because he said, Gary, he said, this was just like in my dream. He said, I could walk right up and touch the tires. So, of course, I took photographs of the tires. I went inside, by the way, to ask the people, how long has this car been sitting in front of their store? He said, oh, about 20 years. The car had no oil in it. He said there was no oil in the car. And of course, it had no mineral oil sitting in front of a gem and mineral store.
Gosh.
And the brand of the car was a Rambler Ambassador. And remember, he talked about the British Embassy. So at this point, I'm really scratching my head. However, I didn't need a credit card to get into the store. There were no tires along a chain-linked fence. There were no umbrellas. And there was no Spirit of God that I could tell. So, of course, we went back to the hotel, and we wrote down the things that fit, and we wrote down the things that didn't fit, and we called it a day. But clearly, he had gotten a lot of information accurate, even though I thought that he was going to be inaccurate. Well, now the weird part happens, and this is where it gets eerie. We were running out of digital videotapes, and I told Christopher, I said, look, I said, I have an hour before I have to get to the laboratory, because I was still, you know, running the lab in the afternoons. I took the mornings off to work with him, or early afternoons if necessary. I said, how about if we stop at a store that I know, where they'll have a lot of them and they'll be relatively expensive? He said, fine. So I took him to Costco. Now, it turns out that Costco in order to get into Costco, you have to show your credit card. When he saw me showing my membership card even to get into Costco, Christopher said, I told you that you were going to need a credit card to get into a store.
Oh, my.
Now, I discounted that initially because I thought, well, gee, he planted the suggestion, and then I went to the store, so I was not going to count that piece of information. Well, we look at me, shop for the videotapes, and then he says, Gary, he says, I'm hungry. I said, you're hungry? He says, yes. I said, well, Christopher, I said, I have to get to the lab. He said, well, I'm hungry. By the way, Christopher is sort of a high-maintenance guy. I mean, he's a sweetheart, but he's, you know, he was hungry. So I said, well, the only food that I could possibly imagine that we'd have time to get would be fast food at the Costco's. So he said, fine. So I bought him some sort of chicken and cheese sandwich, and we sit down. And then he says, Gary, look. And what are we sitting against? Across the hall from us is this long chain-link fence with rows and rows of tires, just like he had drawn in his dream.
Wow.
Now remember, this is not part of the, quote, experiment, right? This is post-experiment, but there is the evidence. So now I'm looking at this chain-link fence with the tires, and then he says, Gary, look around. Umbrellas. And I realized that here we are in Costco. This is indoors. But the area where they seat you for food, there must have been 15 large round picnic tables, each of which had these gigantic umbrellas in it. You have to understand this is indoors. There's no sun.
Yeah, indoors. I got it.
These gigantic umbrellas. So now I'm looking at these umbrellas and saying, what's the probability of this? And then I noticed there was writing on the umbrellas. And I read that writing, and I realized that I would never forget this for as long as I lived. The writing was advertising for Hebrew National Hot Dogs, and their slogan prominently displayed on the umbrellas was, quote, we answer to a higher authority, unquote.
Oh, my goodness.
Ergo, the Spirit of God. Now, when I put all that information together, you try to calculate the probability that anybody could have known that level of detail. And all of a sudden, I was left having to ponder what kind of a system, what kind of a non-random, super intelligent system could not only orchestrate potentially all of this, but make it possible to demonstrate it and for some human being to potentially sense it. And it was that critical day in the experiment that my eyes opened to the possibility that there was some sort of higher intelligence operating behind the experiment that I had to open my eyes to, that there was more to this than just detecting catastrophes in the future or, you know, dangerous events happening. But there was something greater going on. By the way, and then you can ask some questions about this, and we can talk about the critical day 10 when I was forced to entertain the God hypothesis. Midway through this whole process, I think it was day 3 or day 4, it's in the book, but I don't remember the details right now. Christopher had a, quote, nightmare. Now, this is a man, by the way, who regularly dreams about murders and mayhem and, you know, horrible things happening, terrorist activities and so on. But he had a nightmare, and he shared this nightmare with multiple people, including just people that he met in the bar at the hotel. And what he shared with me was, he said, Gary, he said, are we going to somewhere in the East Coast, possibly New York? And I said, no. He said, well, I had this dream of planes crashing into tall buildings and thousands of people dying. Now, remember, this was in August of 2001. And I said, planes crashing into tall buildings? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about, Christopher. I said, if this is something that you think is potentially going to happen, you should call your operatives in England. I said, but I have no idea what it is. It has nothing to do with this experiment as far as I know. And unless you have any specific details about this, I don't know what to say. So I dismissed it, and we went on with the experiment. When he returned from England after this extraordinarily successful experiment, his dreams about these planes crashing into tall buildings continued. And literally 2 days before 9/11, and by the way, he would call me every now and again and tell me that these things were happening. I couldn't even fathom it. I mean, it was so much beyond my imagination. You were talking about beyond imagination before earlier in your opening comments. And when I learned this, I said, look, Christopher, I said, if you're having details about when you think something like this is going to happen and you know where it's going to happen, you should contact the London Embassy or the U.S. Embassy. I don't know what to tell you. And he did. He actually sent a DVD of the 10-day in Arizona experiment to show that a scientist had actually looked at what he was doing, that he did have a history, that he had important information. He couldn't share it. He needed to share it in person. He wasn't just going to put it into an envelope. And he had it delivered to the embassy. They did not get back to him within the time frame. And then 9/11 happened.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, there are so many people talking about the universe this or the universe that, and are all the events, even seemingly unimportant things like, you know, words on umbrellas or a water tank or that happen in the universe, are they all recorded somewhere in a kind of future hard drive that people like Christopher can access and then bring back to the present? Because, you know, I could see big events like 9/11 or earthquakes or, you know, things like that. But, you know, the idea that we're going to go 10 of 20 different places and I want to see how closely you can predict where we're going to go and what you're going to see when we get there. It's clear that Chris was able to receive or to send out his consciousness into the future and get very, very accurate data, lots of it, about where you were going to be and what you were going to see. So it does open the idea that perhaps consciousness or awareness can stretch out to that point. And I guess the question I have is it the unconscious that does that, and Chris has just learned how to communicate so well with his unconscious mind through his conscious mind that he can bring it back and give it to Gary?
Well, that is a super great question. What Christopher believes, and the conclusion that I was led to come to after the 10th day, we can talk about that, the days 9 and 10, so you can really understand how I came to this conclusion, was not that his consciousness went into the future, but rather information was given to him about the future. You know, and there's a big distinction between whether we reach into the future or whether the future is, quote, given to us.
Oh, yes, I would say so, yeah.
And what he suggested was that the information was actually being provided by other, for example, in his dreams, he would often receive assistance supposedly from deceased policemen or deceased people who had been murdered who would give him information. Or he believes that, and I was, of course, completely agnostic about this, that he receives information directly from the source. And it's not like he can just go to the library, if you would, and look up a piece of information and read it from a book or a hard drive. But instead, he has to request the information. And then an intelligence will dictate what information is given to him and in what form. And it's not so much the taking of information, but the being gifted of information that is what led me to be open to the idea that this might be a process that was mediated by higher spiritual beings and ultimately the highest of intelligence. And let me, if I might, give you, since we have the time, if we do, to share with you and your listeners day 9 and 10.
Yeah, so let's do that. That sounds good.
Yeah, because that will then help us put, of course, the rest of the book in context. Because it was partly this experiment that convinced me that I had to share the rest of what became the God Experiments book. It was now day 9. And again, Christopher had been accurate on 8 days. And my writing partner wanted to visit. And he asked me, he said, Gary, he said, could I come out and actually see what's going on? And I said, sure, if you wanted to. And he said, can you pick me up at the airport? And I said, I don't know. I said, it depends upon where we go. I said, if it's going to be local, if it's going to be, you know, close to the airport or to the university, then I should have time to pick you up before I have to go to the lab in the afternoon. I said, however, if it's one of those places that are far away, such as Nogales, which still hadn't been picked, or, for example, the top of Mount Lemmon that hadn't been picked, both of which would have taken virtually the whole day to go there, do the things, you'd explore it, and then come back. I said, I won't be able to pick you up. You'll have to take a taxi. So he said, okay, we'll see what happens. So it's now day 9, and in the morning, Christopher sees that we're going to be going to a place where there are lots of parking meters, he said. We're going to be going to a place where there are lots of satellite dishes, towers with satellite dishes and antennas. He said, we'd be going to a place where there was going to be a murder that would be take place not too far from where we were going to go, and that it was going to appear in the front page of the newspaper the next day. He also saw us going to an airport, that there were going to be 3 people, he and I and one other person. He also said that at the airport, he saw these black and white, small little planes that looked like arrows, Indian arrows, black arrows, and that they were going to be making a lot of noise. Now, of course, when I heard about the airport and the planes and so on and so forth, I said, well, gee, that might be that we're actually going to pick up my writing partner. But, of course, I didn't know what was going to happen because it depended where the place was. By the way, the parking meters and the satellite dishes and the murder, I had no idea where that was going to be. Well, I get the information. I call my writing partner, of course, who's still in California in the morning, and he tells me that where I'm going to be taking Christopher is downtown Tucson. And I was planning to park on what's called Congress Street, which is where I would go when I went downtown. Now, that's only about 10 minutes from Christopher's hotel, only 7 minutes from the university, which meant I would have time to then pick up my writing partner, okay, in the afternoon. Well, we went downtown to the place that I would normally go, and it turns out that that's a row of parking meters. I mean, the whole, you know, it's a downtown city street. It's a small downtown Tucson, but it's the place in downtown where you have to use a parking meter. We walk along, and sure enough, I mean, of course, I had never noticed this before, but a block away off of Congress, there is this gigantic tower with, I don't know, 10 or 15 different satellite dishes. I mean, really a dramatic satellite dish, as Christopher foresaw it. And then he said, I don't want to stay around here anymore. He said, there's going to be a murder not too far from here, and I just want to go. And I said, Christopher, I said, shouldn't we look in the newspaper? Maybe it happened yesterday. Let's look at the newspaper. He said, Gary, my dream was very specific. It's going to happen. It'll be in the next day's paper. By the way, the next day's paper, sure enough, front page, there was a murder not far from where we were in Tucson. Well, so we go back to the hotel, and then we have time now to pick up my writing partner. Now, this was before 9/11, remember. This was a couple of months, or a month before 9/11. And we didn't have airport security yet, so you can go right up to the gate. And we go up to the gate, and we hear this thundering sounds. And it turned out that what happened was, because there's a Davis Moffett Airport base, and every now and then they use the runways at the airport for practice. And sure enough, there were these black jets coming in and landing, you know, touching down, taking off, making these thunderous sounds, and they look like little black arrows. So I said, okay, that's fine. But that still doesn't necessarily speak to the intelligence question. That's just Christopher getting information. So then, this is the big part. Christopher asked me about Saturday, because this was on Friday, and my writing partner was now picked up. And he said, well, what's going to happen tomorrow, which is the last day? And I said, well, I said, Christopher, I said, I didn't tell you this, and there was no reason for me to tell them this. I said, but it just so happens, because of the timing of when the experiment began, that it just so happens that I have an appointment at the medical school at noon. After we go to the medical school at noon, there's a conference that's going to be in the afternoon starting at 1 p.m. that I'm one of the keynote speakers. So I said that if the place that we're being taken to on Saturday is close, then I can take you. If it's far, Bill Simon, my writing partner, will have to take you because I'll have to go to this event. And then he said to me, Gary, don't worry. He says, you're going to get there in plenty of time. And I said, why? And he said, because my dreams in June were very clear. On day 10, we would end very early, and I would spend most of the day at the pool. Now, I said, what? I said, you're telling me that in June, you dreamt that the experiment was going to be over quickly and that I was going to be, the experiment was going to be over and you were going to spend time at the pool. He said, yes, that's what my dream said. I said, but Christopher, I didn't even know that I was going to be speaking at this event and we didn't know when the experiment was going to start. He said, Gary, that's what my dream said. So I said, that's really interesting. I said, if there really is some sort of guiding, remember the G-O-D experiment stands for guiding, organizing, designing process. If there is some sort of guiding, organizing, designing process that's literally playing itself out in this experiment, then tomorrow we've got to be done the very earliest of any of the 10 days. And I said, if we end up going to Mount Lemmon or to Nogales or any of the distant places, then your early information will be wrong, and then I won't have to worry about the idea that there was some sort of higher intelligence potentially coordinating Bill's schedule and your schedule and my schedule and all this stuff, knowing about this and playing some sort of role in it. Well, as you can imagine, that night prior to the 10th day, I was a bit nervous. I was nervous because what if Christopher was correct? Well, day 10, what does he hear? He says, I'm seeing a park. I'm seeing it looks like a London park. Lots of tall green trees and grass. He says, I see an Army ROTC building. He says, I see us having to cross over to a stream, some sort of running water or stream, a small brook or stream, to get to where we're going. That was basically the information. Well, I'm thinking to myself, where is there in Tucson in August tall trees with grass where there's a brook of running water and like RO Army type buildings? There was only one place that I could imagine that was left on the list, and that was the top of Mount Lemmon, or the trip to Mount Lemmon. Now, the Mount Lemmon trip, it turns out they were doing construction at that time. It would have taken 2 to 2.5 hours to get to the top and another 2.5 hours to get back. So I realized, well, I said to myself as I heard the information, Christopher's wrong, and his dream in June was wrong. I'm not going on the trip. I don't have to worry about this timing question. Well, after we get the information, the envelope is finally opened, and where we're going is the Arizona State Museum, which is a Native American museum, on the campus at the University of Arizona.
Uh-huh.
It's literally like four or five blocks from the medical school. It couldn't have been closer. I mean, it's virtually at the medical school. So I'm in shock. But I said, well, you've got the information wrong. So I thought. Now, it turns out they were doing construction on the main entrance to the old part of the campus where this museum is. So I pulled into the south side, which is a place that I normally don't park. And we're walking along, and all of a sudden I notice that there are these tall trees on this side of the campus. Now, as I said, normally the psychology building is on the new side of the campus, not the old side of the campus. My lab was off the campus, so I'm not in this part of the university. So I said, Christopher, I said, look, there are tall trees here. Christopher says, they're not my trees. Now, Christopher, by the way, very often would reject information that I thought might fit, because he's not just sort of grabbing, trying to get accepted information. It's got to meet his sort of standards of being a detective. So we walk along. There are more trees. And finally, we hit this area, which is like a park. Literally, grass, lots of shade, and so on, which is the entrance to the old part of the campus. And he says, this looks like my London park. And the street that was closed off, I didn't realize this, it was actually called Park Avenue or something like that, which is very amusing. So I said, a London-like park. Now, they're doing construction here, and they're running water, apparently, because they're cleaning the streets or whatever, and there's this stream of water that we literally have to cross over to get to the museum. So we cross over the stream. I note the stream. We walk up to the Arizona State Museum building, and it's closed. We can't even go in.
No.
The experiment is now over. 1.5 hour. It's 9:30 in the morning. We're done. Now I'm in shock. I'm totally in shock. What's the probability of that? That his dream in June, would he then get details that relates to London parks and greenness and running water? So we're now walking back to the hotel. He's, of course, thrilled because now he's going to spend the time at the hotel pool, which, of course, doesn't really count because, you know, he knew the dream said he was going to be at the pool and he's going to pick me at the pool and so on and so forth. But we're walking back. I'm in shock now. And then he looks up and he says, Gary, look at that building up there. And there is literally the university's Army ROTC building.
Wow.
He had gotten every detail correct.
Now, he had these dreams before he even came over to this country, right?
That's correct. Especially the dream about the knowing that the 10th day was going to end early. At the earliest, yes. That was in June. Before I'd even picked the sites.
Right, right.
Before we had scheduled when he was going to show up.
You know, there are billions of people out there who know that the future is always in motion, and yet they get feelings, they get visions, impressions, and
yes.
And some even claim they get guidance from other worldly sources, like higher guides or even the deceased, like Christopher says, that helps them negotiate this future.
Mm-hmm.
Are you convinced now that they can actually see the future?
Well, here's what I'm convinced of, first of all. I'm convinced that Christopher could do this. Remember, I'm a scientist. I'm very conservative. I have to see data, and I have to see it replicated before I come to any firm conclusions. Now, Christopher, of course, is, quote, an outlier. I mean, on a bell-shaped curve, he's on the far end of the somebody who's devoted his life to doing this kind of thing.
Yep, I agree with that.
So he's going to do this better than most. So the conclusion I've come to is, yes, Christopher can do this. And Christopher, who's more experienced than virtually anyone on the planet in doing this, as far as I know, is convinced, after years of doing this, that the information is being given to him by intelligent processes.
Mm.
That it's not that he's, quote, grabbing it, taking it out of a data bank. And the evidence from the 10-day experiment was more consistent with his hypothesis than the more conservative or the simple one, which is that there's like an Akashic record or just a place where future possibilities are stored in the quantum vacuum of space or whatever, and somehow our consciousness just goes in and plucks out a potential, quantum potential, and then realizes it, that it seems to be more complicated than that. Having said that, I have worked with a number of other people who have precognitive events in dreams or in waking, which, so I know it's not unique to Christopher. It's just that I haven't done formal experiments with most of these people.
Sure,
before,
sure.
You know, just witnessing it. And what Christopher's convinced of is that any of us can do this to various degrees.
And well, let's make a distinction between let's call them states of consciousness. There are the conscious and then the unconscious. So
absolutely.
Well, first of all, help us understand these definitions, and then I'll go on with my question.
Sure. Well, you know, typically what we mean by conscious is the things that we can be aware of, that we can report, that we can either sense with our conventional senses or that we can intuit. And what we call the unconscious is information that are the things that we're not aware of, that we don't have any typically sensory awareness of, but nonetheless can influence and direct our consciousness. And for me, the way I try to remember this is that take the optic system and the nature of photons. You know, our eyes are finely tuned to see a sliver of the spectrum of photons, what we call the visible range. We don't see infrared, we don't see ultraviolet, and we don't see all the frequencies that are on either side of it. We're, quote, unconscious of most of the actual light that's present in the electromagnetic spectra. We just see the little bit that we experience as the, you know, millions of colors that we can see. But we're unaware of these other vaster amounts of frequencies of light. But those frequencies can nonetheless influence our consciousness. In fact, they can even affect what we see, but we can't directly see it. So that's a simple way of thinking about, quote, conscious and unconscious.
Well, okay.
Would you agree with that?
In a sense, I'm trying to get to this point. You know, there's, let's call him the hypothetical unconscious dreamer for whom the universe has revealed a picture of his future, a small one. He dreams that the company he works for is going to close for good in 60 days. However, the managers just had a big annual Christmas party and told everyone things were never better. But right as rain, the company closes. He is now out of work and destitute because he didn't act on his dream. He didn't save up some money, didn't put away a little rainy day, didn't put out any resumes. So how to utilize the information provided him by the universe? Well, like most people do, they just kind of unconsciously blow it off and go, wow, I had a feeling, you know, a couple months ago this was going to happen, and then it happened. But, you know, does he become convinced that he can actually see the future and that dreams are important? I don't know. But I'm trying to make a point here. He has observed something that should be impossible if the universe was just all chaos and entropy.
That's right.
And so, you know, there's enough proof out there. And Christopher is, as you say, the outlier, but he is the consummate proof that there is a source of information about what is going to happen. And then we have a choice to either go along and witness that it's true or to take that information and step onto another plane of reality.
Exactly. We have a choice to either further seek that information, learn how to interpret it, and then act upon it, or to blow it off, dismiss it, ignore it, and to not even know that it's present. And what's very interesting about this process is that not only is the information potentially there and always there, but it's a skill that we can develop if we're open to.
I agree with that. And so now we have this this shining example in the front of your book called The God Experiments, and you're right, it's G period, O period, D period, and Again, this stands for Guiding, Organizing, and Designing. And if you want to get the book, it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all your normal bookstores. And, in fact, that's where I bought his, was at Barnes & Noble, and I read the book and then called him up and asked to interview him. So we also have the average person, and what we're going to try and, well, just explain to us what Keep It Simple Science means. You tell us about your sand painting experiment.
Yes, okay, thank you. First of all, as a philosophy, there's something called Occam's Razor, which was actually made famous for the public in Carl Sagan's novel, which then became a movie called Contact, where she describes Occam's Razor using the phrase saying, all things being equal, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one. Scientists prefer simple explanations to the extent that we can find them. And that's the approach that I tend to take as well. And there was a profound lesson which preceded by almost, it was close to 20 years, the Christopher Robinson experiment, that first set me on the path to the realization that, quote, order doesn't occur by chance. And that was the sand painting story. And if I could briefly share that with your listeners, then we can talk about it. And the basic idea is as follows. If we take a white sand and we put it on the bottom of a plate or pot, we can then put a specific design with black sand into that pot. We can, for example, draw a heart, or we can draw a brain, or we can draw a cross or a Jewish star, or we can write the word God, or we can write the word dog. We can put some specific pattern of information in the sand. And by the way, Native Americans, who make these very exquisite sand paintings, they have this very, you know, they have these sacred symbols and images which most of us don't see. The ones that we purchase in stores are just sort of approximations of some of these things. But it requires some sort of an artist to have a design and to carefully put these into the sand painting. Anyway, we take whatever it is. Let's say you've written dog or you've made a star. It doesn't matter. Then what you do is you cover the pot and you shake it. And then you open it and you look and see what happened to whatever it is that you put with the black pebbles on black sand on top of the white. Then you shake it again, and you open it, and you look again. And you do this over and over. And the question is, what happens to the pattern that you made? Does the heart turn into a brain? Does the star turn into a cross, or vice versa? Does God turn into dog, or something else? Well, when you do the experiment, what you notice is the same thing happens 100% of the time. And when I mean by 100%,
you just get gray sand.
Yeah, so what happens is it mixes. The sand mixes. And it mixes, and this is not random. It's 100% reliable. And the more you mix it, the more evenly distributed the black and the white pieces mix. You never get a sand painting in the absence of some sort of designing, some sort of ordering process. In the absence of an ordering process, what nature does in that kind of a context is it mixes. And
exactly.
That was completely inconsistent with our models of statistics, which is that if you do things enough times, by chance, complex orders will appear. Because the assumption is that if sand is just like flipping a coin, heads or tails, you know, you flip them enough times and you'll get patterns. You could even get all heads or all tails enough times if you flip them enough times. And the claim has been, well, if you have an infinite amount of time and you have an infinite amount of random processes taking place, by chance, order will occur.
Right, the potential of all potentialities.
Right.
Gary, let's go ahead and take a commercial break right now. We'll just take a quick 3-minute break, and then we'll come right back with more of Dr. Gary Schwartz. Don't go away. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the Law of Attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, our second hour. Our guest tonight is Dr. Gary Schwartz, author of The God Experiments.
The Food and Drug Administration made history Friday as it approved the first drug made with materials from genetically engineered animals, clearing the way for a new class of medical therapies. GTC Biotherapeutics said regulators cleared its drug AT-Rhine, which is manufactured using milk from goats that have been scientifically altered to produce extra antithrombin, a protein that acts as a natural blood thinner. The drug's approval may be the first step toward new kinds of medications made not from chemicals, but from animals altered by scientists. The FDA won't allow thermal imagery to be used to harmlessly detect breast cancer years in advance of existing mammography, but they will allow new species to be used to make human drugs. Start writing your congressman, Earth Explorers. Now, we've added some new affiliates this week, and this one is going to be really great. CampusBookRentals.com. The banner is at X2 Radio.com. They will reduce your college student's book bill by thousands of dollars. If you have a kid in college, you will appreciate this new company. Now, textbooks can be rented for a semester and then returned, just like renting a movie. Click the Campus Book Rentals banner at X Squared Radio. We have also added Vista Prints. Everyone needs a business card, so why not get yours for free? That's right. There are over 100 styles of business cards that you can get for free by clicking the Vista Prints banner at X Squared Radio. The prices are great, the shipping is quick, and the quality is better than you can get at your local printer. Come on. Leave your mark by leaving your card. Vista Prints at X Squared Radio. In the last hour, we were talking about probability, and we were really getting ready to get into it. Dr. Schwartz was describing sand paintings, sand images that are done by Native Americans. They're extremely complex. You've seen sand mandalas left by Tibetan monks as they chant, and you can see these complex patterns, but you also know that there's just no possible way. As many times as you want to try it, you can throw all the sand you want in the air, you're never going to get anything but dirt. It's just not going to happen. So welcome back, Gary.
Hi, thank you.
You know, so now, before we get into this, let me quote something from the book, The God Experiments. It's really the several profound things in this book. I want you to get the copy. It reads really well. It's got a lot of great endorsements. You write, in fairness to mainstream scientists, the generally accepted model they employ to explain the origin and evolution of order in the universe is a bit more complex. The model assumes that chance is combined with physical laws and chemical laws that limit and guide the ordering process. And so here's an opening for some thought. Someone once asked, what are the odds that the universe would arrive at carbon as the basis for all life? And I thought that was a pretty profound question for a while, and then, you know, one would simply think that this is a simple probability calculation. There's, what, 30, maybe, let's say, 20 elements that could be the basis of some kind of life. So you basically have a 20-factorial calculation, and now you know the odds of what it would be to come up with a carbon-based universe. That's simple enough. But when chance is coupled with laws, like you mentioned in your book, then the limits placed on the possibilities are narrowed to a choice of perhaps three or four elements, maybe only one, if you consider that for something to be organic, it must be able to burn. So now we're left with the realization that only carbon-based universes can form. So is this a case for intelligent design as well?
Well, the argument against intelligent design has always been the opportunity for chance. And we actually make calculations. I mean, I've taken multiple statistic courses. It's required for a PhD in psychology. And you know, we're taught how to calculate probabilities. But there are two assumptions in statistics which the statisticians sort of ignore when it's applied to nature. By the way, most physical scientists ignore this or don't understand this as well. And very simply, it is that in statistics, in order to obtain what's called a, quote, normal distribution, a, quote, random distribution, each event must be independent of every other event. In other words, each time you flip the coin, for example, the coin must be flipped afresh. And the second thing is that the coin can't change over time. It can't wear out over time. It can't learn over time. So everything must be independent of every other event. And when you do that, when you create such an artificial, I'll explain in a second, artificial circumstance where each event is in fact independent of every other event, when you do that, you actually get a normal distribution 100% of the time. Meaning, if you have a computer, approximate independence, and you do a large number of trials, you always get the same distribution. You never get a square one, you never get a triangle one, you never get an inverted U. You always get this distribution of probabilities, and it has a particular, precise form. Now, the question is, to what extent does nature fit the criteria for independence of events? And starting with Isaac Newton, what we learned was absolutely not. Even Newton recognized that physical objects, which supposedly had a gravitational pull, which pull in all directions up, 360 degrees in a sphere in all directions, and supposedly this gravitational field extends infinitely into space, each event, each mass, when it's moving or is moved, it literally pulls on and influences every other object to various degrees, particularly ones local to it, but also more distally. Now, and that was the first field that we knew that extended into space. Now, of course, we know that there are other fields that extend into space and that they also go out in all directions. And so everything we know about the physical universe is that things are not independent. Quite the contrary. Everything is interconnected by fields. Now, when you model interconnectedness, you never get a random distribution. I repeat, you never get a random distribution, because random distributions only occur with independent events. So there's a disconnect in our science between the statistics that we apply versus the reality of how we know the universe actually operates. And once you realize that we can't use the assumptions of randomness to explain order, we then have to search for some other way for ordering processes to occur. And that's also, again, part of the logic, keep it simple science, part of the logic that leads one to say, well, if sand paintings don't happen by chance, and if interconnection is the rule and not the exception in nature, then when we see order, particularly the emergence and evolution of order, we have to look for ordering processes. And I use the acronym guiding, organizing, designing processes, not in the sense of an Allah or a God or a great spirit, although those terms often refer to something that is an organizing process. I'm referring to, if you would, the universal inference of the of that which creates order.
Well, I'm questioning the terminology, not the use of it, but maybe the definition.
Please. I like questions.
When we say order is created, it kind of puts a different energy on it than to say order, spontaneously seems to arrive.
Absolutely.
And you kind of had an aversion to, well, I won't call it prejudice, but I mean, we go about our scientific lives and somebody comes up to us and says, well, you know, God feeds fishes, or, you know, because God has blessed us, the crops are growing well, when we kind of know it has to do with the rain and what's in the soil and, you know, the amount of sunlight that it gets, the normal photosynthetic things that make crops grow. Yes, we had a bounty, but, you know, was it made or did it just happen? So let's get some definitions out of the way, because I love when people say that most scientists don't understand statistics, because they don't. They don't. They have to take a class in stats,
right?
But it doesn't mean they understand it. And if, you know, for those of us out here that have degrees in statistics, we really get miffed when we hear things like 4 out of 5 dentists recommend, because there are prejudices that go with statistics. So, you have some definitions. What's the illusory correlative?
What's the illusory correlative?
Right.
Okay. Well, in psychology, the term illusory correlate is when people attribute relationships to things, associations to things, where there is no association. And there's actually been a whole series of studies where people can be led, if they're not keeping track of information, to infer that certain things are linked to other things. And then when they actually calculate the odds, they find out that they're not. So the term illusory correlate specifically refers to thinking that a relationship's there, when in fact when you do the calculations, you discover it's not.
That's sort of like having your wife tell you, the transmission went out because you changed the headlights.
Right. You got it.
All I know is when you put those headlights in, the transmission went out. So
right.
You better check it out. And those of us that know cars know that there's no connection between the headlights and the transmission.
Absolutely. Yes.
So what about self-deception? That's a familiar one.
Yes. Self-deception, of course, is where you're talking about deceiving of oneself, where there is an implicit motivation to avoid certain information and to adopt a certain bias, which turns out not to be true. And there are all kinds of self-deceptive processes that take place. We might think that we're more attractive than we are, or we might think that we have a specific talent that we don't have, or we might believe that we're not responsible for something when we are, or sometimes we might believe that we are responsible for something when we're not. And usually when one looks at self-deception, literally there is an aspect where the individual is recognizing that the deception is taking place, and then another part of them where there are, if you would, suppressing the information.
Very interesting. Now, what about confirmation biases?
Confirmation biases are when you presume that, or you believe that certain events are occurring, and then what you do is you selectively find instances where they fit, and then you ignore the pieces of the information, or minimally discount the things that don't fit. So if you are selectively remembering the things that support your belief, and you tend to forget or actively avoid finding the information that doesn't fit, you end up confirming a belief that actually is erroneous.
Now, we see this a lot, you know, especially in grad students that want the work to come out the way the proctor has sort of led them to believe the experiment should go.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to do that in our professional lives. You know, NASA does it. The automotive industry does it, and everybody just throws out data that doesn't agree with where they want the hypothesis to go. And I'm sorry to say it's true, but it is, and that's why, you know, we write things down in lab notebooks so we can go back and get all the data. And when you're trying to raise money to, say, scientifically prove the existence of God, you want to avoid those prejudices. You want to avoid those tendencies like confirmation bias to say, oh, if it has anything to do with religion, I'm throwing it out. So you have to remain open to gather all the data.
And it's really a challenge to do that, because all of us have emotional reactions to certain kinds of you know, beliefs or not beliefs, in fact. And I hope we'll have time to get to this, but when I myself, for example, really had an aversion to the word God, and that aversion so colored my perception that, you know, you hear the expression throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The tendency for us to get beyond the way either the way we want things to be or the things that we find aversive is one of the huge, if you would, meta issues that I hope that the God Experiments book raises for people. Because on the one hand, it's sort of normal human reactions to have these kinds of feelings, and yet we have to, if you would, just transcend them. I think in the God Experiments book, I had a quote about from Carl Sagan. If not in the book, it was certainly discovered afterwards, and it's on our website, which has to do with the heart of science is being able to, if you would, to give up one's most cherished belief as a function of where the evidence takes one.
Oh, that's good. I like that. I mean, what happens if the evidence, you know, it was pretty well known that Carl Sagan was, you know, really not a believer. He was, I would say he was an atheist. Maybe he was an agnostic, but he definitely didn't profess himself to be a Christian or a Muslim or a evangelical Christian by any sense of the word. He was the consummate scientist and questioned everything.
Yes.
So to have him say that in his quotations would be like him saying, all right, if the evidence showed irrefutably the presence of God, then I would throw out, I would discard my preference for no God, and I would become a believer. That would be...
And I think that's a key phrase that you said, my preference for no God.
Right.
You see, scientists shouldn't have preferences. What they should have are preferences for truth, the pursuit of truth, whatever it is. And I explain in the book that, you know, I was actually... Part of the reason I was able to write such a book and have this journey is that I was blessed to have been actually raised... And my writing partner used this label. He says, you were raised to be a, quote, orthodox agnostic. And
that's good. I'll write that one down.
So orthodox agnostic. And to an orthodox agnostic, whether the question is there gravity or is there God, it doesn't matter what the question is. My response to that question is, I don't know. Could be yes. Could be no.
Could be no, right?
The data. I'm open.
Well, we have one more definition, and then we're going to, and the reason I'm laying this down, because millions of people come back over the next couple of weeks, and they listen to the archives, and we try to lay out a good, intelligent, you know, foundation, so that when we get to the third hour, we really get out there beyond the imagination, they can come back and get the definitions. What are false memories?
False memories are when... We, over time, although it doesn't necessarily happen over time, I mean it can be shorter rather than longer, we end up recalling events where anywhere from certain details having been modified or misremembered to literally imagining things that never happened. And by the way, all of us, well, I'll reframe this, most of us have less than perfect memories. And over time, our memories can change. They can change in certain qualities, in certain characteristics. And the particularly with traumas, There are literally circumstances where people will either falsely remember or not remember at all certain events, which again is a false absence of a memory for something to happen. And the reason for keeping detailed records and writing things down is so that you can go back and not fabricate information. Because otherwise, if you literally, just like confirmational biases, the confirmational bias is actually a form of a false memory, because you're remembering and coming to a conclusion which is not really what happened.
Well, that's exactly right. And it doesn't just affect people in science. It affects people in everyday life. They
absolutely
attribute false memories, false data, or they throw out data, or they taint it, or they remember things differently. And it's not just a matter of witnessing it differently, like three different people witnessing the same car accident. This is the same person really not just fooling themselves, but carrying false data and false conclusions forward with them through their life. And I think you know by now what that does is it sets up lenses and echo surfaces in your consciousness, in your living, that affect the way you make decisions in the future. You can actually trump yourself right out of success by building an allergy to wealth by assuming these false memories and collecting this data incorrectly. And really that's what clearing is all about, is going back and getting the story straight so that you can move forward through the future without trying to force your own future threads through it.
Beautifully put. By the way, the phrase allergy to wealth, is that a phrase that you use often?
No, I just made it up.
What, you just made it up right on the spot?
Yeah.
I love it. And you know why? It's going to relate hopefully to something we can get to, buried in Appendix C of the book, maybe in the third hour. But it has to do with what are called synchronicities and highly improbable events. I've never heard the phrase allergy to wealth before. And literally this morning, I finished reading a novel, a very long novel called The Fire. And the last two pages, the very ending pages, and I circled this, the author describes the character, and she's describing what wealth is. And I didn't know that wealth actually comes from the Greek wheel, W-E-A-L or something like that, which ultimately relates to wholeness and health and unity. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but I love that definition. You know, we attribute wealth to opulence. Like, okay, Shaq is rich, but the guy who signs Shaq's check is wealthy. And that's, you know, that's the kind of opulence that creates resentment and haves and have not feelings in this country. And that isn't what wealth is about at all. It has nothing to do with how long you spend on the phone making deals or how many toys you have in your garage. It's a state of being.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's remarkable that you spontaneously talk about an allergy to wealth in the context of this conversation. So I'm honoring the moment.
Oh, that's great. I like it. Life should be nothing but moments, one after the other.
That's correct.
You have a story that was related to you, and you put it in the book, and I thought it would be really great to put that story right here, because we're going to go forward talking about observation and its effects both ways, both coming into you and going out the other way. Tell us about the black box story.
Thank you. Thank you for asking about that. The black box story teaches a tremendous lesson, and it was a critical story which led me to then be open to asking questions, and ultimately about, can we humans actually communicate with the higher intelligence, if this higher intelligence in fact exists? And the black box story is as follows. I learned this actually, fortuitously, learned this after my first year of graduate school. And obviously it had a strong imprint on my mind. And this is how I remember it, and I don't claim to have a perfect memory, but it works for the story. A big black box fell out of the sky and landed coincidentally somewhere in Arizona, which I now happen to be. And it created a large crater, and a federal government came in and surrounded it, you know, in the fence and kept people out because they didn't know what it was. And they brought in their best scientists to try to figure out what was with the box. And at first they brought in the physicists, and the physicists do what physicists do. They would attempt to understand the properties, the mass of the box, and bombarded it with particles and so on to see if they could figure out the nature of the physical properties of the box. And try as they might, they could make no sense of the box's properties, unlike anything they saw. Then they brought in the chemists, and the chemists do what chemists do. They pour acids and bases and try to look at different kinds of chemical reactions and so on. And again, try as they might, they couldn't make any sense of it. Then they brought in the biologists, and the biologists do what biologists do using the tools that they had. They look for oxygen consumption, and they look for various properties of carbon-based life or any other digestive process or whatever. And again, try as they might, they couldn't make any sense of this box. And finally, as a last resort, they brought in a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I think I called her Dr. Smith in the book. And Dr. Smith sits down at the box and takes out a piece of paper and a pad, and she says to the box, "Hello, my name is Dr. Smith, and I'd really like to talk to you. What's your name?" And the box replied, "Harry." Now, the interesting thing about that story was the first, if you would, take-home lesson that I heard from the story was that it's important to ask the right questions, that that you have to use the right tools and ask the right questions in order to get the right answers, and that you have to be sometimes willing to even ask what might seem to some to be foolish questions or silly questions to potentially make a discovery. So to an Orthodox agnostic like me, the fact that the Dr. Smith asked a question and the box gave this ridiculous answer became a key to sort of keeping an open mind and be willing to be creative about asking questions. But years later, there was a second take-home message about this story, which I realized went beyond those original lessons. And that was the nature of the way in which Dr. Smith interacted with the box compared to our conventional physicists, chemists, biologists. And by the way, I was trained in physics and chemistry and biology, and I loved those sciences. But I ultimately became a psychologist. And that is that what Dr. Smith did was she actually, first of all, introduced herself. She showed respect. She gave of herself first and then invited the box to reply. So instead of attempting to simply take the information or to simply do things as if the thing was inanimate, what she did was she, quote, asked and invited a response, if you would, a more feminine or a more gentle approach. And the notion that nature might respond to invitation, as opposed to merely just, if you would, instead of raping the box, so to speak, to get the information, inviting the response, led me to realize that if there is a higher intelligence, if there's intelligence at all levels, that these qualities of our intention of how we deal with something and the extent to which we are, it's a two-way process. It's a collaboration as opposed to merely just a one-way process, suggests a strategy for expanding one's ability to, if you would, allow nature and and encourage nature to, so to speak, share or reveal her secrets.
Well, is there a chance that in the observation, the physicist, the chemist, the biologist, and then finally the psychologist, with the first three, that the observation effect was sterile and one way. But with the last one, the observation effect was interdependent. It went both ways. She expected the box to give her an answer. And the other ones, they wanted to derive the answer from their own physical or chemical measurements. And that interdependence of the two energies, the one in the box and the one in the observer, is where we want to go from here the rest of the program, because this is where the data, the seemingly random, mindless, chaotic energy of the universe, and those of us that think we're sentient and sovereign and immovable and creative, interact. This is where we intertwine one with another. And what is going to happen for the next, probably hour and a half, is we're going to realize that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
Yes, in fact, what I find so curious about all of this, that kind of interdependent philosophy, is that actually comes out of what's called systems theory. And systems theory, as you know, is derived from the biological sciences and also the engineering sciences, which is that instead of, it's not just that A affects B, but B also affects A, that A and B share energy and information. And it's through their relationship, their interaction, that properties, where the quote whole is greater than the sum of its parts, actually emerges. So implicit in the notion of the systems approach is this kind of collaborative, mutual dependency, interaction kind of a framework. And of course, that was also the framework that I had been was raised in as a scientist, so it dovetailed very nicely with the story of the black box.
Right. So, I mean, do we see any evidence of chance creation here on Earth that you know of?
Well, it depends what you mean by chance. In fact, in the book, what I said was, the conclusion that I came to, is that first of all, what we call randomness does not occur by chance. Randomness only occurs when there's relative independence of events, and that requires a precise set of conditions. But the second thing I said was that what chance does, what we call chance, is actually it provides the opportunity for orders to emerge. So if you mean, does chance play a role in the expression of order, I would say yes, but not in the quote, in the random sense, meaning that even when randomness occurs, randomness is not random. It requires a set of conditions to allow the opportunity. So what I said was that what chance does, things don't occur by chance. Instead, chance provides the opportunity for new orders to emerge.
Right, exactly. This reminds me of, there's an author, his name, well, he's actually a professor too, Dr. Dean Kenyon, and he's the author of a textbook called Biochemical Predestination, which was a national bestseller. It's pretty rare for a textbook, especially one in a subject like biochemistry. But in joining that fame as a professor, he happily taught his course and his theory until one day a grad student asked him a question he couldn't answer. He said, Dr. Kenyon, I agree that proteins can replicate with errors, and that if these errors work to the advantage of the organism's survival, the new protein will stand a good chance of being replicated in its new form for a while, and that organism may change, may mutate. But where did the first protein come from? And after an embarrassing moment of stupor, Dr. Kenyon was driven to go back to the drawing board and rethink his position. He decided the first protein must have been engineered intelligently.
I'm going to have to read that book.
Well, it's kind of a cool book because in the preface of every chapter, it, just to keep the interest of someone who might follow such an obscure science as biochemistry, my brother's a biochemist, so I'm ribbing him, he puts some narrative and kind of gets you thinking about biological predestination and his thesis, which is great, but now he's a proponent for intelligent design. So, you know, the disbelief in this principle comes when scientists realize that changes in the universe that would be consistent with such a realization as intelligent design are nullified by the limitation of the speed of light. I mean, they just kind of rest their reputation. You can talk all you want, but when you get to the speed of light, that's it. That's the limitation. So things would have to spontaneously or intelligently create themselves in limited corners of the universe. Hence, man is the only intelligent life in the universe, right? So let's talk about the quantum field and super interdependence.
A nice light question. One, by the way, the assumption that you've just made is, of course, that nothing travels faster than the speed of light. And as I know you're aware, there are now some scientists who claim that under certain conditions, things do travel faster than the speed of light.
Sure, that's what we're getting to.
Right. And also, even in quantum physics, the whole phenomenon of what's called entanglement, and the notion that, in its extreme form, that two quote photons or two electrons that were initially joined traveling at the speed of light going in opposite directions, that when you attempt to measure one, the other one shows a quote instantaneous change. What's interesting about, independent of their distance supposedly, what's interesting about this is that the term quote instantaneous. Instantaneous is actually either a theoretical interpretation or it's a limitation in our measurement systems. And, of course, if something that would travel faster than the speed of light, it would appear to be instantaneous. And yet, in fact, it might have taken some, quote, finite amount of time. Now, remember, you're talking to an orthodox agnostic. So to the orthodox agnostic, my response is, look, I don't know if the speed of light is actually, quote, the limitation. I know there are circumstances under which it appears to be the limitation. But there are other conditions where things don't act that way. And what we
there's the assumption, the speed of light is a fixed amount of distance in a certain amount of time.
Right, and that assumption, as you know, is not met by quantum entanglement.
Right.
And so, and if you actually take the logic of quantum entanglement and then you try to integrate that with the notion of, quote, the Big Bang, where everything was ultimately unified, then everything in the universe to various degrees is still entangled. Nothing is, quote, independent, and all of this operates, quote, faster than the speed of light, if not, quote, as instantaneously.
Yeah.
So
even if it isn't all interdependent, it's certainly regionally interdependent when supernovas recreate corners of the universe.
Absolutely. And remember that one of the things that's so amusing about what we look at the universe is we see replications of order and uniformality of structures and functioning of distant galaxies which by the speed of light wouldn't have enough time to communicate with each other. And yet they're seemingly replicating in their orders, which again implies what? That there's some sort of commonality, some sort of metastructure that is persistent above and beyond the our normal senses. You know, we infer, one of the huge take-home messages, at least it was for me when I first had the aha moment about the sand painting was, you know, I said, imagine that you're walking on a beach and you come upon this exquisitely designed, exquisitely organized pattern of sand. You know, a bunch of dogs, for example, playing with each other carefully, patterns observing in the sand, when you know full well that by random, that if you just allow the sand to mix, it will mix. The question is, what's the probability that some sort of intelligence put that design there? And as you know, the conclusion I came to was it's virtually 100%. And so the notion that we see these replicated orders at all these different levels, and we now know with quantum physics the degree to which there is all of this entanglement and interconnection, you then are further led to the conclusion of looking for and being open to inferring the invisible intelligence. And by the way, for me, since I'm now comfortable realizing that most of what exists in nature is invisible to me anyway. Remember, my eyes only see a tiny little spectrum of all the photons that are there. Literally, what physics has told us is most of what the universe is invisible to us. That we have to infer those energies by measurement devices that then convert them into senses that we can experience with. So
right.
Ultimately,
even if we have to do it vicariously, like I can't see that gravitational body out there, but I know it's pulling on this star a certain number of times per year, and so therefore it has to be this big and it has to be that far away.
Exactly.
And through its perturbation of this visible portion of the universe, I know it's out there.
Exactly. The same logic that we use to infer the existence of a gravitational field, the same logic is the logic that derives us to infer the existence of an invisible intelligence.
Well, now you were discussing photons and,
right,
you know, being a, well, let's just call it a quasi-massless particle, and it appears that all photons are pretty much identical except for their frequency, and that they will maintain that energy level over eons of space until they reach our telescope or our radio antenna or whatever it is we're going to detect it with. But aren't photons really just stored information? Aren't they just a transfer of information in some interdependent way?
Yes, and what's even more remarkable about photons as being, that's why the whole universe is storage of information, is that, and I'll never forget when it dawned on me the lesson of what's called interference with lasers. You know, you can take two lasers, point them at right angles to each other, and when the beams cross, if the waves are, quote, in phase, they will actually add, they'll combine. If they're completely out of phase, they'll cancel each other out, meaning they'll appear to be invisible. Yet once the beams cross, the photons continue as if nothing had happened.
Well, that depends on if they're obeying particle or wave function. You know,
no,
wave functions, you'll get constructive interference.
Yes, but once the beams have crossed with the constructive interference, they reappear as if out of nothing.
Right.
Okay, so therefore they've not actually interfered with one another. All they've done is appeared to disappear. But they didn't actually disappear, and they didn't actually affect each other. They just were, it became invisible to our detection. Now, why that's really important is because if you think about this, and again, I talk about this in the book, that if we could imagine ourselves going out into space and being a tiny little space, a tiny little, you know, very tiny little dot in space, we realize that starlight coming from billions of stars and billions of galaxies are all crisscrossing through any given space simultaneously. So all the galaxies to the left are crisscrossing through all the galaxies on the right, and the galaxies up and the galaxies below, all that light is crisscrossing simultaneously, and yet none of it gets mixed up. Light doesn't behave like billiard balls. Light's, quote, invisible to light. And that property of light is what allows for information to be retained and for light to have a kind of immortality. And that is, therefore, physics actually provides us with an excuse to think of the universe as a gigantic memory storage system, informational storage system.
I was talking with Dr. Fred Robb, who runs the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Hanford, Washington. And magnificent facility. If you get a chance to go to one of these, there's one there, one in Louisiana. It's a good public tour, fantastic education. But he made a really neat admittance, and a consolation, and it fits right here. He said, you know, a lot of the things that we observe with this interferometer, because it's extremely sensitive, it can sense down to 10 to the minus 23rd negative centimeters. And he said, it appears as though photons are blinking into our existence from another dimension. He said, I know that sounds really weird, but they can't come from any other place than just beyond the next millimeter, but in another dimension, because it's pure information, pure photonic energy, but it didn't travel here from across space.
It's very interesting for him to say that.
Well, yeah, I mean, but he would think that, you know, they would kind of avoid talk like that, especially in a government facility.
Well, maybe on your radio show he talks like that.
Well, no, I spoke to him in person. He didn't come on the program. Oh. I went up to the observatory and you know, spent the day there with him and his two engineers, one chemist and one mechanical engineer. Just brilliant, all three of them, and just a great, great facility. But they're discovering things because they're listening down in just the very, very small vibrations of the universe, trying to detect a black hole for the first time. And this is the observation that they make. You know, gee, we're seeing information come into our dimension from another dimension, just beyond the eyelashes.
Well, that's one of the things I love about honest physics and creative physics. That people will actually follow where the evidence takes them.
Yeah, exactly right. They're not afraid of that, and there's no personal pride there. Like, there used to be a religion to science. It's still out there. The high priests are still out there, but there's enough creativity now and enough speed of transfer of information and papers and publishing now that things can go fast enough that you don't have to make it to the next world physics convention and be the first one to stand up and talk about some new relationship. You can do it today, globally, right now. And so the ownership is beginning to dissolve, and people are realizing that they're not coming up with the idea first. The idea is already out there, sort of like our friend Christopher, who could be given the information from whatever source it was he asked. Gary, we got to take another break, just about 4 minutes, and then we'll be back, and then we can probably run long. So let's go ahead and take a break right now. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio after this. Friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer.
There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. And welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad to have you. Hour 3 on February 8th. Coming to you live from southern Idaho. GOI-1 was launched September 6, 2008, and is touted by the company as the world's highest resolution commercial imaging satellite, capable of distinguishing ground objects as small as 18 inches across. Be careful what you're doing in your backyard. Somebody's watching. Engineers from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and students at the California Institute of Technology have designed and tested a versatile low-mass robot that can rappel off cliffs, travel nimbly over steep and rocky terrain, and explore deep craters. Let's see here. This prototype rover called Axel might help future robotic spacecraft better explore and investigate foreign worlds
such as Mars. About a half a year ago, before the robotic arm on NASA's Phoenix Mars lander began digging into the soil and subsurface ice of an Arctic plain on Mars, six scientists traveled to one of the coldest, driest places on Earth for soil and ice studies that would end up aiding analysis of the Mars data. They will be testing Phoenix Robotics in the Antarctic region. In this third hour of X Squared Radio, we have our guest, Dr. Gary Schwartz. He's the author of The God Experiments, How Science is Discovering Every God and Everything, Including Us. And in our last hour, we were talking about photonic information, photons blinking in and out of existence and coming into our universe with information. And we were talking about interference, constructive interference, destructive interference, and interferometers. And one of the things I wanted to talk about in this hour, this is where we typically go well beyond the imagination of most Earth explorers out there. I also want to let you know we're opening the phone lines this hour. So if you've been out there on hold or you've been thinking about calling in, you have a question, you can do so. And we're going to run a little long this hour, so don't worry about ending up at a quarter till. The way we usually do, we'll just go a little bit long. There's no one after us, and we can accommodate and reach out a little bit further tonight. Dr. Schwartz, whenever I'm talking about energy and how it interacts with one another and constructive and destructive interference, we always seem to get around to the idea of resonance and things annihilating each other or helping each other. Is there a ratio of perfection at which energy interacts with one another for creation instead of destruction in the universe?
What a deep question. First of all, if we return to the nature of energy with photons, we can get back to the point that what we witness as, quote, constructive and destructive interference is having no effect on the light itself. What we call constructive and destructive in terms of effects require there to be some sort of, if you would, systemic interaction, which often appears when we have something that we call mass or something that is which has some limits attached to it. And resonance, by the way, is obviously a profoundly important phenomenon. It's fundamental to physics. By the way, I happen to be a musician on top of other things in my past. And in fact, I played professional music for 10 years. And so I have a deep affection for the capacity for resonance of various kinds of objects. Because musicians deal with that, particularly if you play stringed instruments or percussion instruments. And so I would like us not to lose the idea, which is the theme of the God Experiments book, that literally what we mean by the evolution of order allows for the possibility then of also, if you would, I'll say something strong here as a prediction, if you would, the evolution of energy itself. That what we're literally seeing is the continued unfolding of a universe, and that this unfolding process, which allows for creativity, and which allows for apparent spontaneity, that all of this is a process that is continuing to unfold over time. But by the way, the word evolution originally meant came from the word evolve, which means to unfold, and that therefore the what we witnessed historically versus what we will see the continuing emergence of could be ever new, if you would, phenomena and complexities. I used I quoted something in the book where I said, imagine you stepped outside the entire universe and saw what looked like these, quote, caterpillar galaxy slowly but surely readying to transform into a rainbow-colored universe of indescribable beauty, a rainbow-colored butterfly universe of indescribable beauty. The whole idea that we could be dealing with this continued evolution of ever more complex unfoldings is something that we should not rule out, because that's what the history of the universe suggests anyway. I don't know whether that's helpful or not, but I think it's an important sort of implication of what's unfolding. And the other thing that's really, I find truly extraordinary, since you use the words consciousness and so on in the show, is the notion that the idea that, if you would, that mind and consciousness may actually be what's primary in the universe, and it's mind and consciousness which then gives way to information, energy, and ultimately matter, also becomes one of the deep implications which curiously serves to bridge science and spirituality in an ever-unfolding way.
Well, I'm touched. I mean, there's so many profound angles to this. First of all, I love the idea of the butterfly universe. That's amazing. And, of course, I'm not surprised at all that you're a musician because of your attraction to physics. If it was chemistry, you would obviously be a poet, because all chemists are poets.
Is that right, by the way? That's curious.
Yeah, it is. My undergraduate degree is in chemistry, and I built cars for 29 years with the automotive industry, and we had a visiting chemist come in, and prior to his presentation, I just, you know, just frankly asked him, what kind of poetry do you write? He said, how did you know that I wrote poetry? I said, because you're a chemist. All chemists are poets. It comes with the mental mathematical construct of understanding the language of chemistry. You just become a poet. And for physics, it's resonance and music, and you're attracted to the mathematical beauty of the sounds.
Isn't that fascinating? By the way, I was a chemistry minor. So maybe that's where my appreciation for poetry at least comes in.
So you wrote lyrics along with the music.
Not very good, but...
So, well, whenever we think about energy becoming matter, really collapsing from the wave function to the particle function and becoming something that we can put between two pieces of bread and consume, we have to talk about the resonance of energy coming together. First of all, let me say, we have a caller on the line, so caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, this is Barry in Tucson. I just want to regress for a minute back to the statement that things can travel faster than the speed of light, and remind you guys that Maxwell's equations survived the Lorentz transformation. And to me, that would imply that the fact that they are reassembled intact, that does indeed state that is the limit of the speed that anything can travel.
Well, it would be, and Lorentz, of course, was brilliant, and if it wasn't for him, we would not have cell phones or GPS satellites, because if we tried to put all the GPS satellites up there taking relativity into consideration, the darn thing would never have worked. So the idea...
But you could take relativity into consideration, and it would work. That's the whole thematic thing that I'm trying to present.
Well, the premise we're trying to push here is that there's some non-locality to the universe that has nothing to do with distance and time, but rather links information through this interconnectedness, this entanglement that we have a lot of experimental data for but really can't explain in terms of, gee, I'm 10 light years apart, therefore it should take 10 years for anything, no matter how fast it's going, or at maximum speed, to get from point A to point B, and yet I see an effect at point A and point B instantaneously. So there must be a short circuit somewhere.
Exactly, and that's a question of identity rather than measurement and you know, the way.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That's exactly right.
Yeah, by the way, Barry, you know, I appreciate the comment, that remember that you're speaking with someone who happens to be a, quote, orthodox agnostic, which applies to everything, including the equations that we use. And now what I mean by that is that the history of science has been the constant evolution of being open to, if you would, adding more factors to equations or deriving new mathematics that will help explain phenomena that aren't handled by earlier equations or earlier theories. And I think that for me, the humility that I've come to is staying with the data. In other words, if there's data that suggests that things are different from the way mathematics previously predicted, then my attitude is, well, let's follow the data and see what we have to do to revise that which we have adopted.
I agree wholeheartedly with that approach. You know, I'm a double E in radiation and scattering, and you know, the equation served me well throughout my career. And postulate for the purposes of speculation is not real appealing to me, and I really wholeheartedly endorse your approach, and I'm enjoying your talk, so I'll let you get back to it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the call. I love those questions like that. That's really good. Thank you very much, Gary. So when we're talking about energy collapsing into matter, eventually you're going to start talking about the golden mean, the 1.618 to 1, you know, the way beehives and flowers and conch shells and all those kinds of things seem to form in matter out of order. And there's, as you said, a systemic approach, and the system operates with a ratio of energy.
Yes, and there are certain, as you know, mathematical ratios that seem, of which the golden mean is one. And my all-time favorite is pi. One of the things that is so spectacular about these repetition of ratios is the fact that some of these ratios, as you know, that no matter how far mathematicians have calculated the numbers going up in millions or more of digits, they've never been able to describe a pattern. They've never been able to find the repetition. They've never been able to create the formula that could predict the pattern. And as a result, the assumption has been made, well, it must be, quote, random. It's random because we can't find the pattern. And yet what I find so extraordinary about a number like pi is that every time we calculate it, we get the identical pattern of numbers. So here you've got a so-called random pattern, meaning that we can't figure out what the pattern is. It looks, quote, random, but yet it's 100% replicable. We always get the same number every single time. And therefore, then the question becomes, well, is it really, quote, random, or is it just that we have yet to be able to decipher how is it that this particular extraordinarily complex pattern of numbers is actually generated? And that if we had more sophisticated, more dynamical, more complex mathematics, we might eventually be able to better describe it. So what appears to be, quote, random may actually just be extraordinarily sophisticated, or merely be beyond that which we can describe. And that interpretation is one which, again, requires a bit of humility on our part, is one that's also consistent with the idea that order is actually the rule and not the exception. And what we experience as disorder is more our inability to be able to make sense of and describe the patterns that are really there.
Yeah, I'm amused by the term dark matter and dark energy. The fact that we can't see it, I mean, we can see the effects of it, but we can't see it, we can't detect it, so we just naturally call it dark. What if it's extraordinarily bright and we can't detect it?
Well, it's As you know, infrared and ultraviolet could be extraordinarily bright, and we won't even see it with the naked eye. So I think we, again, need to learn that lesson. One of the things that I think it would be valuable for the for your listeners to have a bit of time to ponder is the getting back to the Christopher Robinson, if you would, the psychology of the implications of the physics. Because, so, as you know, I try to bridge back and forth between the statistics, the physics, and the psychology, is the notion that if there is this kind of organizing intelligence that, quote, transcends space and time, is like a quantum hologram, and it persists at all levels from the micro to the macro and so on, and that everything is an expression of it, including us, we then, in principle, because of our more enlightened or evolved consciousness capacity, have the capacity to, quote, interact with it, that we have the capacity to even, quote, communicate with it, and therefore become more in communion with it. And that this, of course, is one of the most controversial of the implications of the God Experiments book, and I think it's one of the reasons why the book has been as challenging to some and as resisted to others, because of the idea that the so-called mystical experiences that people had of communicating with a higher intelligence may not necessarily all be a sign of schizophrenia or all be a sign of hallucination or wishful thinking or self-deception. But they're actually, again, maybe, again, the metaphor of the baby with the bathwater, that there may be this this opportunity for increased communication and understanding, but it requires that we be open-minded and open-hearted about receiving such communication. And in the book, The God Experiments, I actually shared how, from a systems point of view, you combine quantum physics with systems theory, and you are led to this as a plausible prediction. And to someone like me, who's so data-based, and so, you know, I got to see the evidence, and I have to see it repeatedly replicated before I'm going to take it seriously, that the idea that all of us could be metaphorically like Christopher Robinson and not necessarily have to do it in our dreams, but we can do this with, if you would, treating our minds and treating the universe like a, quote, black box, asking questions and then potentially getting answers. And is that something that you would like to have a little bit of conversation with about?
Well, yeah, we're talking about, you know, the complexity and even methodology with which we observe. And the observation, whether we're asleep, dreaming like Christopher was, or whether we're awake, you know, or in the shower, when we receive that information, when that information is given to us, from what I can understand from the data that came in on this experiment that you did, the information did not come in the form of words like Christopher, you know, this and this and this. He was shown images, pictures, in which he related them back and had enough experience to say, oh, that's an umbrella, that's a stack of tires by a chain link fence, that kind of, this is what I'm going to see when we get there. So the imagery that came to him was recognizable to him, whatever icon that it came with, he could interpret it. So when we get a feeling and we can't sharpen it to the point where we can get an image and we know what to do, we know, you know, when to stick our glove out for the ball of the universe to fall into it and catch it.
Good metaphor. You really have a lot of poetry in you.
I appreciate that. But there is an effect made on the universe by our observation, by our observing the future. It has already changed.
Yes.
And once we figure that out, once we awaken to that fact, once we become conscious, we become purposeful beings, then we start observing on purpose. and we start observing to make things happen. And my question is, relative to this golden mean, relative to this construct of interference, to this understanding how and when to purposefully tap the universe so that you can get this resonance going and make a sound or make something happen with a little bit of energy repeated precisely over and over again, like Tesla would do. How do you know when to do that?
Well, why don't you ask a simple question? You know, and I'm being semi humorous here, obviously. There's a distinction between knowing how to ask a question, how to interpret the information, and probably the deepest question, which, by the way, no one has ever asked me, but you did, is when to ask the question. How do you know when the, quote, right time is to seek the observation? Is there a timing process? Is there a knowing, quote, when to ask? When is, quote, the right time? Is that what you were asking the question about?
In the sense that asking is observing. You're actually injecting yourself into...
Yes. But what's interesting about asking... Yes. But what's interesting about asking is that there's an element of... and by the way, I've spent countless hours pondering what does it mean to ask a question, even of yourself. The whole idea of raising a question and the birthing of a question is itself, to me, one of the all-time great and wondrous things about the mind, that we can, quote, conceive of questions and ask questions, which then lead us to make certain observations. Now, what you're saying is that the very act of asking a question, particularly if it's asking it of a higher intelligence, is that the very act of asking the question implies an observation, right? To ask,
yeah, exactly,
is to observe.
And an implied realization that at some point you're either going to be granted an answer or you're going to be denied the answer. No answer is going to come.
Exactly. Absolutely. The question of the timing of when is something that I don't have any answer to, except that sometimes we're led through intuition or circumstances to ask the question, that we're literally goaded to ask the question, and that could even be called unconscious, and that part of the reason you may be able to get the right answer is because you've asked the right question at the right time, that the answer will actually be present.
But that implies some kind of luck, like the higher being comes to... Man, if you'd have just asked that question 5 minutes ago, I would have given you the answer.
Right. And also, it implies that the higher intelligence is actually inspiring you to ask the question if you're prepared to ask it. So you have to be...
There you
right?
go. Yeah. Now there's the interdependence. Yes.
Exactly. And so that's what means to come in harmony or resonance with the higher intelligence. Because it's gonna know that you have the potential, that it's gonna know that you wanna ask the question, and it's gonna be trying to encourage you that the answer might be available if you're willing to ask the question at a particular time. I wanna get back to something that you said about we used to think that God was the explanation for something, and then we realized that it was a temperature or it was a wind current or it was some physical phenomena that we could measure. There is this wonderful story about you're probably familiar with it, but I'll just briefly repeat it in some version, about this religious person, I don't remember whether he's a rabbi or a priest, whatever, he's out in a boat and he's in a storm, and he's warned that there's a storm coming, and he says, I don't have to go in right now because God will save me. And then a boat appears and saying, look, the storm is coming. You've got to get on our boat. You've got to get back because it's going to be here. He says, no, he says, God's going to save me. And then a helicopter comes in. The helicopter says, look, the storm is really coming. Come up the steps. And he says, no, God's going to save me. And then what happens is that the storm comes and he's killed. He dies. And now he goes to heaven and he meets up with God. And he starts complaining bitterly. He said, why didn't you save me? And God said, what do you mean? First of all, I sent the man to warn you. Then I sent the boat to warn you. Then I sent the helicopter to warn you. And you didn't listen. Now, the take-home message of that is that just because something happens in a physical form doesn't mean that there isn't something behind it which is serving, again, a higher intelligence. That part of the challenge of all of this for us is to get our minds around the idea of a seemingly invisible intelligence, which may be, quote, infinite in its capacity. And I talk toward the tail end of the book about the idea of, quote, infinite intelligence. Now, I started out in mathematics. I mean, I had a passion for mathematics. I was a sort of a prodigy in mathematics, and I didn't stay with it when I went off into college. But in grade school and high school, I was as good in math as I was bad in French. And I was terrible in French. But I was really gifted in math. And one of the things that I spent time with was pondering the nature of infinity and the mathematics of infinity. And once you start thinking about the idea of infinity, and you realize the extent to which infinities of infinities become something that the human mind can imagine, even though we can't even grasp the idea of infinity, we can still do mathematics related to infinity. I began to ponder what would it mean to entertain the idea of something whose intelligence was infinite. What did the idea of infinite intelligence mean? And how would you know if you were dealing with something whose intelligence was infinite, whose IQ was infinity as opposed to 120 or 160 or 200. Now, when you ponder the idea of an infinite consciousness and an infinite intelligence, you just open to that thought. We do the thought experiments of what it would mean. You then begin to realize that that our intelligence is sufficiently limited in the form that we're in, that we only have a tiny little glimpse of what this intelligence might be doing. And by the way, nothing reminds me more of the complexity of just nature itself than a conventional fat textbook. You mentioned biochemistry. When you look at the sophistication of biochemical processes and all the facts that we already know about the complexity of biochemistry, and you realize how much information exists just in biochemistry itself, let alone cellular biology and so on, no human being has the capacity to keep all of that in their head. And certainly none of us would be of intelligence enough to have conceived of what it would take to potentially create such a process, if it's in fact an expression of creation. And to attribute it to, quote, randomness or accidents or serendipity combined with a few laws is more a sign of our own limitation, potentially, than it is of the nature of the process itself. And so, for me, I would rather we humans continue to increase our capacity to imagine what seems to be impossible, and then open our minds to actually receiving information about it. And I think that more and more people today are becoming open to the possibility of even this kind of information occurring to them. And lo and behold, the more open they are to receiving it, the greater the capacity they have to experience it. Yogi Berra had this wonderful phrase, and he says, if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. Which, of course, is exactly backwards from the way we normally describe it. And I think that there's something really true about the openness to seeing something, enabling us to go beyond where we currently are.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And the idea that there's some separation between music and mathematics and art and space and God and us, is, I think, the misnomer. That separation is artificial to us. And the real feeling, no matter how we consider a tribe primitive, like the ancient Egyptians or the Mayans, or whether we think, you know, the think tanks at MIT are the most advanced, somehow there is an innate connection, as you say, an interdependence, a relationship between infinite intelligence out there and what we perceive as our limited intelligence here. But maybe those limitations are upon ourselves, given enough time. Let's say we live 35,000 years or 35 million years. I think I could master biochemistry and architecture.
Right. Maybe there's even a wisdom in not giving us access to all this information and intelligence because we're too immature to handle it.
Well, maybe it's our design. We don't want to have all the information. It would be extremely boring. Where's the challenge in knowing and in having faith in the evidence of things not seen and things hoped for? You know, that's what makes humanity so interesting. But when you begin tapping into the limitless reservoir of intelligence that's out there, either the way Chris did it, or the way we traditionally do it, by just keep pouring textbooks into our minds and trying to understand it and gain wisdom by it, we realize that we are connected to that intelligence. We're not separate from it at all, except by our own choice. And so,
yes, exactly.
Let me tap into your mathematical genius just for a moment. We know the Italian mathematician Fibonacci, and the fact that he discovered a progressive sequence in numbers that appears in the way nature increases using this ratio of 5, this 1.618 to 1. I mean, everyone knows, well, maybe you don't, but you know the alphabet, A, B, C, blah, blah, blah. If I ask you to recite it, you would start with A, you wouldn't start with L and go through M and forward. And when we ask freshmen, you know, algebra students to recite the Fibonacci sequence, they start with 0, 1, 1, and so forth, 2, and on upwards. And I stop them at about, I don't know, 10 or 12 numbers into it, because you can see the pattern of adding the last number to the next one. And I say, okay, divide those two numbers into one another, and they do it, and guess what? They get 1.618 to 1. Well, that's understandable, and they pass the exam and all as well. But then I say, now let's take two numbers that are not related in any way. Let's just take 45 and 316, okay? They're not divisible into each other, they're not both even, will everybody agree that they're completely random? And they say yes. All right, let's add these two numbers together, and you get, let me do that real quick, 361. And then add 316 to 361 and so forth. And what happens is when you get out to eight numbers, eight iterations, and you divide the two numbers into each other, you get 1.618 to 1 every single time. This order that arises out of two random numbers coming together and adding themselves together eight times is how nature increases. And that resonance is how waves collapse into particles and become three dimensions.
You know, there's a book that was just published. I'm blocking on the author's last name. It may be Lavia or something like that. And it's called Is God a Mathematician?
Oh, right, right. I know that author.
Yeah. And the whole idea that hidden within, or not so hidden right now, within patterns of numbers are the building blocks of virtually everything that we see, and that why mathematics is the universal language, is something that I think if anything inspires awe in me, it's order that emerges in mathematics. And then secondly, it's the order that emerges in astrophysics. You know, when you start seeing superclusters of galaxies, or you you start seeing the non-random patterns of the background radiation that's been recorded with the COBE and the more recent microwave, you know, recording systems. It's the overabundance of this, both, if you would, simple orders and also elegantly complex orders, and that they're interrelated. It's a tremendously humbling and awe-inspiring experience, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, it's nigh unto inspirational when you see these things, you know, pop out of textbooks, or when you start combining two seemingly unrelated things like music and physics, and you see a correlation that's inspirational, that just, you know, brings tears to your eyes, the beauty of it, the amazing synergy in it, you then become convinced that there is some intelligent order, some layout, and I don't want to use the word teleology, but there's some kind of unfoldment to the universe.
Yes, and again, for me, as someone who has lived in the world of psychology, in terms of his professional training, getting back to the idea that this quote, this organizing intelligence exists in everything, including us. It's not just quote out there. It's in everything.
Sure.
Everything is an expression of it, including our capacity to have relative freedom to make choices. Is part
you,
of
you lay this out in your book. You lay this out in your book really clearly. You say that there are five ways of thinking about how design operates on Earth and perhaps in the universe. Maybe you could explain those five things, those five ways.
You know, do you have them in front of you? Because I don't remember all five.
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. I think I do. I have, I actually wrote the questions down, and then I have notes. I have post-it notes sticking out of your book everywhere. In the chapter, you say changing one's paradigm is not easy. Millennia passed before humankind discovered that energy is the basis of matter. It may take a few more years before we prove that wisdom and knowledge are the basis of and can actually create energy, which in turn creates matter.
I did quote that, yes. But one of the things, I apologize for not having the book in front of me and not remembering those five different levels of design. But if I remember correctly, it included the individual designer up to the collective designer versus the, if you would, the meta designer, of which can be impacting on all of those designers, and that all of those design levels could be operative even simultaneously.
Right. The first three were just, you know, right on top of each other, just kind of interrelated. And then the fourth was independent, and the fifth turned out to be the God design.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, one of the things that I find really spectacular about the implications of all of this, and I'm going to share with you some new data that goes beyond the God Experiments book, if you'd like to hear about the latest, absolute latest work coming out of our laboratory that speaks to this, because it deals with discovering order and Fourier analysis of patterns of cosmic rays and the expression of the quote light of God in a laboratory context, and I promise I'll get there in a second. But the notion that we can actually seek information, request information of a guidance nature, and literally receive communication that is of, and I'll use the phrase, of a universal source. In other words, that we can literally receive information that relates to universal principles by asking questions of a universal nature. The idea that this is accessible to any one of us to the extent that we are we have an open mind about it, and that we ask the questions with sincerity, that we're willing to follow the information where we get, and most importantly, again for me, that it's verifiable, that we can receive information that we wouldn't have known ahead of time, and then we can later determine that it actually has predictive power, that it's quote true. That's partly for me one of the most important hypotheses that emerge from all of this, is that that just like, and you know, all of us on the planet have access to air of various degrees of quality, but it's up to us to more actively and consciously breathe it. But it's all there around us constantly. We're constantly breathing, whether we're aware of it or not, during the sleep and so on. But we can still learn how to breathe better. We can learn how to breathe more deeply. We can learn how to oxygenate our blood more effectively than the way we might normally breathe, and people teach breathing patterns. That the same thing applies ultimately to receiving all of the information that's there that we're literally composed of, that we have not yet accessed. And what I'm hoping is that future science is actually going to address our capacity to, if you would, you know, be in communion and communication with the larger universe, and then therefore be able to have precognitive information, to be able to receive guidance, to be able to see solutions to contemporary problems from this wealth of information that is potentially be granted to us. One of the things that we're doing right now, in fact, I've just finished a draft of a new book. It's called The Sacred Promise, An Urgent Call for Reuniting Science and Spirit, which provides some of the latest research that we've done, which has not appeared in print anywhere, because it's all new. Much of it's occurred within the past 12 months. But it's really important that this information be communicated timely and also in the big picture. So it operates in a lot of different areas. Is that we've been doing research where we've been investigating the possibility that when healers who engage in the process of asking for divine assistance and in what's called spiritual energy healing. By the way, have you heard of a technique called Joe Ray? Most people haven't, but
I haven't heard of that technique. No.
Okay. Well, most people haven't. It's not unlike Reiki. It's not unlike healing touch, various energy, spiritual energy healing techniques. It just happened to be a particular one from Japan that we've been currently investigating, partly because they have a large center in Tucson. But these individuals believe that they invite, quote, the light of God to come into them. And then they invite this light of God to come through them and to be used for healing for the best and highest good. And there have been various studies documenting that these individuals have effects in terms of people's subjective experience, their physiology. They can affect not only humans, but they can affect animals, they can affect plants. And it's not unique to Joe Ray. There are many different techniques that invite a universal energy to come into them and through them, and that supposedly has intelligence. Well, anyway, I have in my laboratory a very sophisticated, super cooled, low-light CCD camera system. It's cooled, our particular camera's cooled typically to minus 70 or minus 80 degrees centigrade. And it can take very long exposures. And it records, of course, we're recording in the, quote, pitch black. And you can literally image, for example, living systems, quote, glowing in the dark. And we've published a number of articles on this in journals, and it's included in a book that I wrote called The Energy Healing Experiments. Well, anyway, one of the questions we asked was, what would happen if healers invited the light of God to come into them and enter the chamber? Could we detect any changes in this otherwise invisible light, because it's invisible because it's so light. It's so dim, it can't be detected by human eyes. But it can be detected with these cameras, particularly with these really long exposure times. So we typically take a 30-minute exposure in a completely pitch-black, you know, light-tight chamber in a light-tight room, and so on. Anyway, one of the quote, problems with this camera used in that capacity is that it also detects cosmic rays. And literally, you'll see these, relatively speaking, large bursts in individual pixels that accumulate over time, which are supposedly caused by cosmic rays, even though the camera is designed to mostly work within the normal visible spectrum that we see, and slightly into the infrared range. These momentary bursts of these cosmic rays will show up. And, of course, they're much more intense than the background radiation that we're picking up. So you have to statistically remove them. You have to be able to do this. And there's software called ImageJ software for free. It comes from NIH, which provides all kinds of mathematics of image processing so you can detect these images and remove them and average them out and so on and so forth. And a few months ago, we began doing these preliminary experiments, and I was analyzing the data, and the first pass when I analyzed these images, I didn't remove the cosmic rays, because there's only maybe 30 or 40 of them in a run, and they just make little white speckles, and I took these images and I did fast Fourier transforms of the images and then displayed images of the fast Fourier transform. It's called FFT. It's an FFT transform on the ImageJ software. And if the pattern is quote random, and I put quote, I notice I say quote random, the distribution of the FFTs are just different. It looks like a random collection of dots. But to the extent that, and it looks, as you said, gray, but to the extent that there are non-random elements in here, there's any kind of order to the structure, you begin to see ripples and complex structures that appear in the FFT images. And what I discovered was that during the period of time when a given healer was inviting the light of God, that there were these ripples that appeared in the fast Fourier transform of the images. And those ripples were clearly visible compared to what the images looked like during the pre or post 30-minute test periods. When I then said, okay, gee, that's weird. And so what I then did was I created two sets of images now, one which was the quote the normal light removing the cosmic rays, which are treated as quote noise, you know, it's noise in the camera. And then I created an image of the cosmic rays ignoring all the other light, so you have now separated them into the two components. When I then did the FFTs on each of the images, I found that the patterns were much more robust, the ripples were much more robust in the cosmic rays.
Now, was there a fixed frequency to these ripples? Did they make a shape like an orb or a geometric pattern?
Well, there are patterns. They're more like, if you would, like stripes. You have to see how the software generates these FFT pictures. But I describe them like they look like waves in clouds. I had that image just this morning, actually. But let me get back to the huge, important point here.
Okay.
We've done this experiment now multiple times. And we see this, I'm calling it a ripple in the FFT. And it's primarily in the cosmic rays. Now think about this. We assume, number one, that cosmic rays coming into a chamber are random. That's assumption number one. Number two, we treat them as noise. Number three, we assume that this randomness would not be influenced by any kind of higher intelligence, if there was a higher intelligence. However, if there is a higher intelligence, and if this higher intelligence, and by the way, almost all mystics have claimed that the, quote, higher intelligence is of a super high frequency, and that it has to, quote, lower its frequency. By the way, matter, what we call matter, is actually lowered frequency compared
right.
to super high frequencies of light and so on, right?
Right.
So matter is a lowering of frequency. And of course, matter, in order to exist in matter, has to be cooled. You know, it has to be and for us, there's a right temperature which where living matter can be expressed. That if, quote, the light of God was ultimately a super high, if not infinite frequency, but a super high frequency, that it, and if it's an organizing process, then it would actually express itself by organizing cosmic rays. I mean, that's just a simple integration of what the, if you would, metaphysicians claim, and what we know about the physics of light. And the,
well, one might say, you know, gee, it's, you know, wonderful to have this plasmoid show up in your screen, but where's the information? Where's the interaction? I would think, and I might be making a jump here, that the interaction is in the asking of the question, and almost a binary yes or no, or proceed or go back kind of response, right?
It could very well be, okay? It may be that automatic, but I think that it's not just that you ask the question, but the answer has to agree to give an answer. You can ask me all the questions you want, but I can choose to either answer your question, not answer your question, to give you false information. It's a two-way process. Asking the question is step one. But if it's a two-way process, it's not because you ask the question that you get the answer. You get the answer because I choose to answer it. And this intelligence, supposedly, is more powerful and more intelligent than we are, at least in our manifested form. So it has at least as much choice as you and I have. And I'd say it potentially has much more capacity for choice than you and I do in our little individual lives. Anyway, the take-home message here, but I do want to get back to one thing that you've implied, and that is, theoretically, if you ask for God's assistance, so to speak, for the best and highest good, the response should be virtually 100%. It should be as reliable as gravity or as reliable as electron flow. That the presence of this organizing process should affect and increase the order of cosmic rays in a highly reliable fashion. Again, that's a required prediction from this logic, which of course could be wrong. And I think you'll remember that in the God Experiments book, I have a chapter about how consciousness potentially organizes information. And I talked about the work that one of my students did on absorption of his own consciousness and the movement away from apparent randomness in electron noise.
Right.
The Princeton Engineering random event generators.
Right.
That the whole idea that literally the presence of consciousness, intended consciousness, naturally increases organization and structure. To attend is to organize. To observe is to affect. To have some sort of, quote, orderly effect, although we may not be able to understand what that order is. Well, the same thing theoretically should happen with, quote, you know, the God consciousness, the God mind. And all I'm sharing...
With practice, you could observe the way your student did and move the random event generator off of the statistical average.
Right.
And you could do it reliably, and you could do it to get answers. And I'm for one, incredibly attracted to the idea of a reliable God, you know, one that would answer a question to the greatest and highest good every time. And if we can, you know, expand the experiment, and I can't wait to see the data from your light chamber, and I'd love to visit your lab sometime.
You're going to have to come and visit. You have to promise.
I'm down in Phoenix from time to time. I'm, you know, putting together this biorefinery up here in Idaho, and some of that requires, you know, federal funding and different things. So from time to time, I'd be down in that area, and we'll get together. We've run just a little bit over time, and we can do that because there's no host directly after me. But it has been a fantastic, now well over 3 hours, and I have enjoyed it so much. That's why I haven't been asking questions the last half hour. I've just been absorbed in your experiment, and I'm really excited about it and want to see what conclusions and how far you take it and how much data you can generate and publish. I think it's exciting.
It's certainly an adventure. And as I tell people, I have, you know, I take my life at this point 1 minute at a time, meaning that I'm just, if you would, going with the flow, following the data, following comments like allergic to wealth and so on.
That's good. Well, let's stay in touch by email and keep me informed on how things are going, all right?
Well, good luck with all of this wonderful wealth of knowledge that you're bringing to people through the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And you have a fantastic week, and we'll be in touch with one another, all right?
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, that's it, Earth Explorers, and we will play our ending now. And this will be in the archives in about a few hours, and we'll talk to you later on next week.
It has been our pleasure to have you here this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we try to provide the best 3 hours of talk radio on Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours where you live, send the call letters of your local radio station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Be aware that every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.